that will prepare you for a rewarding career in the exciting field of healthcare. You can earn a certificate as a medical office assistant or a 2-year degree in medical office management. For more information, give us a call at 800-585-HFCC.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Hey, this is Stone Perkins. Do you know what my favorite time of the week is? You guessed it, Saturday nights from 8 until 10 right here on WHFR for Five Gears in Reverse. It's an alternative music show that features new indie and even plays older alternative tracks that go all the way back into the 1960s. You'll find it all here, punk, blues, indie, ska, garage, and a whole lot more. So why don't you join me Saturday nights from 8 until 10 for Five Gears in Reverse. Maybe I could make it your favorite time of the week too. Until then, keep it locked right here for all of our cool shows on WHFR 89.3 FM and on the web at WHFR.fm.
Disclaimer. This show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
From the African American Public Radio Consortium and PRI, Public Radio International, this is Maya Angelou's Black History Month special, telling our stories with support from AT&T, bringing people together to connect and create wherever they are. Learn more at att.com/thebridge.
I am Maya Angelou on Public Radio, telling our stories. Our stories come from our lives and from the playwriter's pen, the mind of the actor, the roles we create, the artistry of life itself, and the quest for peace. Alicia Keys.
Somewhere deep down inside of me, I relate very much to gospel music. Without saying like I grew up in a gospel church, I understand it very much.
Jennifer Hudson.
I refuse to just sing anything because I feel like I'm singing my story. And if I have control over that, well, I'm going to control it.
Regina Taylor.
With everything that you write, it is about trying to find the truth of it.
Oprah Winfrey.
I believed that this calling that I feel so deeply inside myself was to go beyond one show.
And Kofi Annan.
All the cruel and brutal things, even genocide, starts with the humiliation of one individual.
Our stories often intertwine with music. The Gershwin brothers use their genius to listen and capture some of the essence of the art in the African-American community in South Carolina and all over the South. Some of the street songs the sellers of strawberries sang, oh, they're so fresh and fine, and there's just off the vine, strawberries,
yes, ma'am.
And the song for fish, and for clams, and for crabs.
talking about devil plants.
Those songs are still sung in the streets of South Carolina, North Carolina, and Mississippi today. So some of the music which has been taken and used have been faithfully recorded and faithfully reproduced. However, it is always best to get the authentic music and art from the people themselves who make the art.
You must take the A-train.
Long before the Grammys, our songs told our story. In 1958, at the first Grammy Awards, Ella Fitzgerald won Best Vocal Performance, Female.
Disclaimer, this show is a W.
Being different
poet. Performance, female. And Count Basie was honored with Best Jazz Performance Group. Scott Joplin. Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, Max Roach, Duke Ellington, Wynton Marsalis, and many musicians would display musical genius that would garner Grammy Awards, some posthumously. Quincy Jones has more Grammys than any other winner, with 27 awards and still counting. Q, one of the most handsome men in the world and a fabulous brother to me and a great musician. And here and now comes Miss Alicia Keys, newly married, a son named Egypt on her hip, telling her story, telling it her way, since she appeared on the scene in 2001, picking up 5 Grammys with her first CD. Hello, my dear.
Hello. So glad to speak to you. That was so beautiful. Thank you for those words.
So many times I noticed the interludes of European classical music in your work. When did you study music?
I was really interested in the piano. My grandmother on my mother's side, she plays piano. And so my mother's also an actress and a very creative spirit and being. And I started to study classical music, and that was about 7.
When you say classical, I always make the distinction that that's European classical.
Yes.
Because American classical has to be the blues, spirituals, jazz, country music, folk music.
You are right.
That's American classic.
You are right. That's beautiful. I love that distinction. So yes, it was like Chopin, Satie, Beethoven.
Yes.
So exactly. It was European classical that I started to study. And that gave me my foundation of kind of how to read music and how to write music and how to play music.
Yes.
You know, my greatest inspirations has been reading and reading different poetry of different wonderful people and people who just have a soulful outlook on life. And you're definitely one of them.
I love the poetry of Paul Laurence Dunbar. I'm still a lover of Mr. Dunbar.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Probably the greatest poet, American poet, ever.
Oh, I think he's amazing.
His internal rhyme and rhythm are so fetching. He wrote a poem called When Melinda Sings. And one of the verses is, "Go and quit that noise, Miss Lucy. Put that music book away. What's the use to keep on trying if you practice till you gray? You can't start no notes a-flying like the ones that rants and rings from the kitchen to the big woods when Melinda sings." I mean, you can't resist it. You just can't resist them.
You sure can't.
I knew you grew up in Hell's Kitchen.
Yes.
What did you hear in the way of music or language which made you feel that you could speak, you had a voice?
Well, in Hell's Kitchen, there's a lot of ambulances, a lot of police sirens, there's a lot of yelling, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of hustle and bustle, a lot of cars, horns honking. It's definitely alive with a lot of life and people from different walks of life and misfits and outcasts and performers and Broadway, you know, dreamers. And then in my mother's house, there was all kinds of music playing. You know, Ella Fitzgerald was playing a lot. Coltrane was playing a lot. Thelonious Monk, I remember. She had a whole rack full of records. And I remember just looking at the albums and looking at the covers of people. I got introduced to Roberta Flack, Nina Simone, Aretha Franklin, Bobby Caldwell, somebody that I loved a lot.
My Lord.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got that string.
Then there was the street sounds too. So there was music blaring out of cars, just in boomboxes on the corner. There was like Salt and Pepper, Tupac, Biggie, Jay-Z, Nas. So there was like a whole different kind of like variety of languages that I was exposed to, as well as poetry, because I think like Nina Simone's poetry or her lyrical constitution is like something so powerful, but so is the rapper Nas. Like, since I grew up listening to him, and he had a certain way of putting thoughts together or words together or lyrics together. And Marvin Gaye, that was a big influence of me.
Made
me understand a little better about how to really start to craft a song, like what a song comes from. I learned was the spirit of it and the feeling of it.
Did you have any indoctrination in the religious music, of the African-American religious music? I include spirituals, gospel, long meter hymns. And I don't know if, do you know the phrase long meter hymn?
Tell me what it means.
One singer in the church or in the group will lead out a hymn. She might, or he might say, I came to Jesus as I was a weary, wounded, sad. And the whole church goes, I came to Jesus as I was weary. Now, and the people harmonize. They start to take lines. And by the time the second verse comes, or even the end of the first verse, you're caught up in a musical and poetic and spiritual spell.
Wow.
We almost don't do that anymore. But sometimes if you go into like a storefront church, the old churches in the South, here in North Carolina where I live,
yes,
I can go and I can hear somebody start lining out a song. Bread of heaven, feed me till I want no more. Bread of heaven. It's so beautiful.
That's beautiful. I think I have a kind of a unique experience when it comes to a religious experience. You know, my mother is, she's Italian. And my father was born in Harlem as well. And my grandmother in the 40s married an Italian man. And that was later, after she already had my father. And so that was quite a journey for her, I'm sure, during that time.
Yes, of course.
So my mother actually grew up heavily, heavily Catholic. So I wasn't kind of brought up in a church. Although I went often with different friends. I have a friend who is like in a beautiful Swedish church, and to hear the style of music there. And then I have a friend who grew up in a more Baptist church. And so I would go with her there and hear the style there. And so I think what happened actually was that I got exposed again to like this variety of gospel.
Yes, yes.
But I feel like somewhere deep down inside of me, I relate very much to gospel music. And even without saying like I grew up in a gospel church or I grew up in a Baptist church, I understand it very much, and like it comes naturally from inside of me.
See, that's what I mean, that you can understand it. You comprehend. Mm-hmm. It's as if you knew it long before you were born, that it was impressed on your brain and in your spirit, so that you came here already ready to know it.
I feel that.
I spoke with Jennifer Hudson.
Yes.
We spoke about you and Mr. Dean.
Yes.
What a blessing that the three of you, and you with other musicians and other composers, other singers, that you all work together and support each other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One time I was on the phone with Stevie Wonder, and he was explaining to me how, you know, there'd be times when Gladys Knight and he and Aretha and everybody would just like get together, talk. They would speak about what was going on socially, how they could do something about it.
Yeah.
I just feel like there was such a different mentality. And I do feel sad sometimes because it is different to my generation and how we think about things. But there are so many incredible moments where you start to recognize that you do become friends with people.
I can't let you go without asking a little about Keep a Child Alive.
What Keep a Child Alive does is we're able to provide the medicine for children and their families who have AIDS and can't afford it, especially in places like Africa and India. When we first started, it was virtually impossible to afford this medicine that exists. And so therefore, the only option was death. That was about 10 years ago. And so since then, we've been able to serve 250,000 people, open orphanages, open clinics started by the people in the area. And so we're able to just help support them. We've been able to actually create a state-of-the-art clinic that was in an area that was totally underserved.
Yes.
You start to know people and you know their stories and you start to see them grow and be able to make it out of what maybe would have been their destiny. So it's really, it's incredible. I love it. Keep a Child Alive.
It's a blessing. As you keep someone else alive, you are enlivened.
Mm-hmm. That is how I feel.
All of these are my children, and I will acclaim them all, and nobody can deny me.
That's right.
And that's who you are, and I'm so proud you're so young and all that and so talented. I thank you, my dear.
What a gift to speak to you. You just inspire me so greatly. So thank you so much for your time too, and for all the light that you give.
You're listening to Maya Angelou's Black History Month special, brought to you with help from AT&T, bringing people together to connect and create wherever they are. Learn more at att.com/thebridge. Up next, Jennifer Hudson, Kofi Annan, Regina Taylor, and Oprah Winfrey. Maya Angelou's Black History Month special is distributed by the African American Public Radio Consortium and PRI, Public Radio International.
Drifting on by, and I'm feeling you.
From New York's Hell's Kitchen, where Alicia Keys grew up, to Chicago's Inglewood neighborhood, where my next guest found music in her church and in her home, I am welcoming a star that found her way in part on American Idol. People tuned in each week to watch this young woman that would later win both a Grammy and an Academy Award. She is a talent who brings her voice to the community as well. You are listening to the soulful sounds of Miss Jennifer Hudson.
That's what I mean. Sleep in peace until the day's done. That's what I mean. And this whole world is a new world and a bold world.
I am impressed with her comportment, the way she carries herself in this world. I am pleased and proud of her as much as if I was her auntie or grandma or related somewhere. And I think we are in any case, Miss Hudson.
Thank you for having me.
What you have is humility. And I see it in you in all the things you do. That is, you know that someone went before you, that you have already been paid for, and that all you have to do is develop yourself so that you can pay for someone else who is yet to come. You started singing in church, didn't you?
Oh, yes. That's where I started. I used to sit on my mama's lap in the choir stand, singing alongside her and my grandmother. And then I got my first solo at the age of 7, which was Must Jesus Better Cross the Lawn.
All right. And all the rest go free.
Yep. And all the world go free.
There's a cross for everyone and there's a cross for me.
Yep.
Yes, I remember that as a young girl. And that was really many generations ago.
My grandmother was like the main soloist in the church choir. So I was like under her wing and she would teach me all the songs. She taught me Must Jesus Better Cross the Lawn, and she would rehearse me at home. I was the kind of kid that stayed up under my grandmother all the time and just basically took after her. On my first album, I did a song that my grandmother used to sing called Jesus Promise. It's a very old hymn, traditional gospel song that I love, and I love tradition.
I was wondering, how did you go from gospel music into what used to be called worldly music? Did that cause you some concern?
Well, to me, it's more of like what you're singing about. I feel like if it was up to my grandmother, I would have never had the chance to sing what we call mainstream music today. I still stay close to my gospel and spiritual roots. So there are limits. And I like to put messages in my music or talk about what I want to talk about.
Exactly.
So I refuse to just sing anything because I feel like I'm singing my story. And if I have control over that, well, I'm going to control it because it is very powerful. And I've seen it manifest in my life.
After the inexplicable death of Whitney Houston, I wondered, what did you do?
Whitney has been like a blueprint for my entire life. I was a little black girl sitting on the church steps dreaming up a dream, you know?
And yes.
She was a part of that dream. You know, she was the blueprint of that. I used to sit in my mother's hallway and sing I Will Always Love You, all of these songs. So Whitney has a very, 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 very special place in my life and in my heart. And then I was blessed to be able to meet her and actually have a relationship with this legend. I just feel as though the best we can do is she deserves to be honored and remembered for her contribution. She gave her entire life to this music industry and to the world through her music. And so the songs that I go to is the songs that make you feel good.
Yes.
And those are the Whitney songs. Like the I Wanna Dance With Somebody's, How Will I Know's, My Love Is Your Love's, I'm Every Woman's of hers. Like,
yes.
It's the spirit and the energy in those songs that just lift you up. It lifts you up automatically.
Thank you for that. And that you remind me and the listeners to do the same thing. I want to talk to you about the healing properties, not just of music, but also some of the things you're doing in Chicago to help the children in your relative's name.
Yes. We have the Julian D. King Gift Foundation
Yes.
here in Chicago. area because it's been so violent. And we want to show the kids that, if first of all, if I came from where you came from, then you can do it too. And we started the Julian D. King Gift Foundation in honor of my late nephew who was murdered at the age of 7. And he was a scholar. He was so into school. He used to call himself Dr. King. His last name was yes. King. And so you had to refer to him as Dr. King. And he was an amazing student, and he was super into education, so we wanted to continue that on.
What a blessing.
Thank you. After the tragedy, everybody wanted to, you know, get a sense of how I felt or what I was going through, how I see, you know, perceive everything. Mm. And I felt the best way I could put it into words was I was like, at times I feel like I'm on the outside looking at someone else. So that's how I came up with I Remember Me.
In this life, anything can hurt you. Push you, then forget you. Erase your history. But I remember me.
At the time, I was 28, 29. I was like, I feel like in 29 years, I've led at least four or five different lives. And it's because nothing is the same for me as it was 10 or 15 years ago. Like, everything that I'm surrounded with, there is nothing familiar that was familiar to me 10 years ago because it's all gone away. So how do I know who I am? Like, I have the same hands, same eyes, same feet, but that's all that's left of me. Everything else is just the memory.
Mm. You performed at the Nobel Prize concert in December of 2012.
It felt like I won the Nobel Peace Prize, like just being a part of that. And so I did. Like, this is amazing honor. And to think that, like, they had several artists from many different countries representing for their countries, and to know that I was able to stand here and represent the U.S. as an artist. The same little black girl.
That's it.
Sitting on the church steps, dreaming.
That's it.
That's me.
Sitting in your mama's lap.
Yes, mm-hmm. In the choir stand. I get to be here to represent for my country. If that don't make you stop in your tracks, I don't know what will. Like, okay.
I don't know what will. It's true. I thank you very much. It's been a delight to talk to you and to hear your wonderful enthusiasm. You know, Miss Hudson, enthusiasm comes from God, the word. N-E-N, thews, for God, the word. Dios, you know, in Latin is God, Theo.
Oh.
So your enthusiasm is volatile. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for having me.
People of African descent have received Nobel Awards in 3 of 6 award categories: peace, literature, and economics. From Ralph Bunche in 1950 to President Barack Obama in 2009, the Nobel Peace Prize symbolizes a prize for people who bring peace with them in their being. We know we are often asked to make peace. These men have shown that they not only make peace, they bring it with them. Kofi Annan, born in Ghana, became the 7th Secretary General of the United Nations, serving 2 terms from 1997 through 2006. He was the first Secretary General who emerged from the ranks of the United Nations because he began working with that union in 1962. It's wonderful to hear your voice and to feel that I'm speaking nation to nation because I'm by choice a Ghanaian as well. How did it feel to share the Nobel Prize with United Nations? I had never read that they had given a prize jointly to a person and to the organization.
I had not expected it when it came. Later, I was to learn that some people lobby for years to get it. It was a wonderful feeling to realize that all the hard work we do has not been overlooked. It was a real shot in the arm, not just for me, but for the entire organization.
I've seen your work around the world, in Bosnia and Yugoslavia and in Rwanda, and I've seen your concern about the human condition. How do you feel that every human being, whether he or she comes from Taiwan or Kowloon or Nkaka, that they are relatives of yours?
Well, I think we can go back to the roots. We are all sons and daughters of Lucy. We all started out in Africa. But quite apart from that, if you have respect for human life and the sanctity of human life, you cannot help but be moved by sometimes the misery and the brutality and the callousness we see around us. I often remind people that paying attention to the woman or man next to you, to the individual, is extremely important, because all the cruel and brutal things, even genocide, starts with the humiliation of one individual.
I'm reminded of being in your company many, many years ago.
Yes.
You listen with interest. It gives some sense of confidence to the speaker. I've met you with James Baldwin. You listen to James Baldwin and the writers of the Harlem Writers Guild with the same interest.
We often have lots of people who are keen to talk, but some of us have to listen, and you always learn something if you listen attentively. When you do the kind of work I do and you get caught in the middle of conflict trying to bring peace and be a peacemaker, you have to listen and listen carefully. I used to tell my team, listen not only to what is said, but even to what is not said, and come back and report. And one of my staff asked me, how do I listen to something that is not said? I said, keep your eyes and ears open. The body will tell you. His eyes will tell you.
When you were working your way up the ranks in United Nations and becoming actually the first sub-Saharan African to hold the post, did you encounter difficulties?
Yes, there are always difficulties in life. And you encounter sometimes awkward or difficult situations, but you deal with them and move on. I recall once I was a director of the budget, and we went into a meeting, and I got there on time, others came, and we kept waiting. And so I asked someone, what are we waiting for? He said, we're waiting for the director of the budget. I said, I'm here. And so we started the conversation. Obviously, he was looking for somebody from Europe or North America,
of course,
of a different color, and we hadn't met before. You run into situations like that sometimes. Actually, it's more the problem of the other person than mine. Eleanor Roosevelt said, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent.
That's it.
And I tell the young ones, never give that consent.
I just wanted you to speak about the Syrian conflict.
Yes, I think what is happening in Syria is very tragic. I think we should all cry for the Syrian people who are caught in the middle. Mm-hmm. It is a society that is a mosaic. Cities like Damascus and Aleppo have been one of the oldest in the world. They are now being destroyed.
Yes.
And often we talk as if it's just two groups, the Alawites, that is the Shia and the Sunni. But we have other minority groups there. We have the Christians, we have the Druze, we have the Turkmen, we have Kurds, we have Assyrians, and we have Ismailia. They all need protection. And they may not necessarily be with the government, but they don't know what comes next. So they are really, really worried and scared. I personally believe that there is no military solution or intervention that would end the conflict, and we need to find a political settlement that lays out a roadmap indicating to the Syrians that each community will find its space in Syria, that the government institutions and security forces will be maintained to be able to keep law and order. Otherwise, we will get into a situation which is much worse than we've seen today, where a party that believes it has won or has the upper hand would go out on vengeful killing or ethnic cleansing of the other.
I wanted to ask you about interventions.
Yes.
A life in war and peace.
Yes.
Why did you decide to write this book?
I decided to write interventions because I have had the privilege and the opportunity of living through a very interesting period, sometimes difficult, exasperating, but exciting. And I lived through some of the major challenges of our time over the last 2-3 decades. And I thought it was important that I put it down, share my experience with particularly the younger generation, and hope that once they've read my account, some will be tempted to go into public service, whether at the national level mm-hmm. or at the international organizations.
I'm encouraging everyone to read Interventions, A Life in War and Peace. It will inform, it will entertain, it will inspire. Just read a chapter so that all the children and the family are sitting around. It's not a bad idea. And then talk about it. Mr. Secretary General, I thank you, Kofi Annan. I thank you, my brother, my fellow Ghanaian, my friend.
Thank you, my dear Maya and my dear sister. All the best.
Thank you.
You're listening to Maya Angelou's Black History Month special, brought to you with help from AT&T, bringing people together to connect and create wherever they are. Learn more at att.com/thebridge. Up next, playwright Regina Taylor and media mogul Oprah Winfrey. Maya Angelou's Black History Month special is distributed by the African American Public Radio Consortium and PRI, Public Radio International.
You've taken my blues and gone. You sing them on Broadway, and you sing them in Hollywood Bowl, and you mix them up with symphonies, and you fix them so they don't even sound like me. Yep, you done taken my blues and gone. You also took my spirituals and gone. You put me in Macbeth and Carmen Jones, all kinds of swing Mikados, and in everything but what's about me. But someday, somebody will stand up and talk about me, black and beautiful, and sing about me, and put on plays about me. And I guess that somebody will be me. Yes, it'll be me, myself, talking about me. That's a poem written by Langston Hughes. The playwright is of great importance in the African-American community. I count among my friends Alice Childress, who penned Florence in 1949, Just a Little Simple in 1950, and later her novel A Hero Ain't Nothing But a Sandwich, published in 1973, would become a film in 1978. And of course, all the gifts of Langston Hughes, his plays about Simple, and then Lorraine Hansberry with her Raisin in the Sun debuted on Broadway as one of the African-American family's challenges and personal trials while integrating a white community came to the stage and later the screen, and it mirrored many of the images and realities in our society. It's amazing. Miss Lorraine Hansberry told one of our truths, or many of our truths, and it allowed us to see ourselves, and it brought to the stage some of the great men and women, among them Sidney Poitier, Ruby Dee, Glenn Turman, incredible young men and women who would later on become icons in the world of entertainment. In 1961, Oscar Brown Jr., who was a singer and songwriter, a poet and civil rights activist, But Kicks and Company, a musical about a man who lived for kicks, brought him to the stage. And of course, that same man wrote some great songs for Abby Lincoln. And I must say, he wrote one for me as well in the early 60s. In that same year, Emmy and a Grammy Award-winning American film, television, and Broadway actor, director, poet, playwright, author, and social activist, Ossie Davis, brought Pearlie Victorious to the stage. Pearlie was set in that era when Jim Crow laws were in full and they affected across the United States and especially in the South. The traveling preacher Pearlie Victorious. It was an amazing play. And of course, Ossie Davis wrote it with his clear eye and clear mind. And of course, his artistry for himself and for his wife, Miss Ruby Dee. The community church with its hope, its prayer, and its dreams have often been the setting for the African-American playwright. And now Regina Taylor, this brilliant actress who played Lily Harper in the television series I'll Fly Away and who became the first black woman to play William Shakespeare's Juliet in Broadway's Romeo and Juliet. This woman has taken up her own pen, and as a playwright in residence at Chicago's Goodman Theater, she has shown an interest in acting and in writing by carrying the connections of the generations into her work and shown her grace by displaying her courage to write the truth, not just the facts. Facts can obscure the truth. Regina Taylor has written the truth about the African-American community. Thank you very much, Ms. Taylor.
Thank you very much. It is such a pleasure and an honor to speak to you, Ms. Angelo.
Tell me about your work with Crowns.
It's a piece that was originally done about 10 years ago, and Emily Mann from the MacArthur Theater sent me this tabletop book about African-American and the tradition of wearing hats. And I'm looking at this book and I'm going, oh, wow, the pictures of these women. Mm-hmm. I know each and every one of them, even though I've never met them before.
I know.
These hat queens, which means you own at least 100 hats. So I started having to ask these questions about what is this tradition? Where does it come from? Why? And it takes me back to Africa, over the ocean, the tradition of adorning oneself for worship. And then I'm looking at all the traditions of the African-American church through the music, again, taking you back to the drum and the ring shout. I'm looking at it going over the ocean and becoming field hollers to jazz through blues. This is part of the lineage of the spirituals, the gospels, the rap today.
I was so close to that piece. I wrote the foreword for it. For Crowns.
Yes, you did. Absolutely.
To see African-American women who, in many cases, only were called Miss or Mrs. or Sister or Auntie or Tutta in the church, and in other places were called completely out of their names. Sometimes the people for whom they worked decided they didn't like the names that the women said they had, whether they were Teresa or Florence. And the employer often said, well, no, I don't want to call you that. I'm going to call you Jimmy. I'm going to call you Ella, just out of perversity. And so those same women who would find a hat to put on to come to church and be called a queen, Queen Neva.
Yes.
I love it.
Yes.
I just love it. Amazing.
Yes.
And I'm delighted to come from a family, a group of people who had so much courage to rename themselves and claim themselves by wearing crowns.
Listen! Don't touch my hat! Now, if you don't know, I'm going to tell you, don't do it. Not the hat. The only person who touches a woman's hat is somebody who doesn't wear hats. All the time you spend fixing it on your head just right is gone just like that. Church accidents can happen when you're sitting down and the pew behind you rises. But if you're quick like me, you duck and see. No hat surprises. Oh, but they still get me from time to time. You got to be careful when you're sitting behind a hat queen.
Yes, yes, they are queens. Also, each hat has a story.
Of course.
About a wedding, a funeral, a baptism, markers in a life.
Yes, ma'am.
A life, lives. And I think it is, with everything that you write, it is about trying to find the truth of it. And that hits home. We did a recent production at the Goodman Theater this past year, and it gave me an opportunity to revisit the play. And setting it in Chicago, the main character, who's a young girl from Inglewood, and that connection that she's trying to find,
yeah, exactly,
to keep her whole. She has to go down south to visit these women who tell her their stories about how they got,
yes,
over in this life, giving her, mm-hmm, courage to move forward. I wanted it to be something about community, bringing communities together. So along with that, I started working with different institutions here and communities.
What are you planning right now, Ms. Taylor?
I'm looking forward to the play for Signature Theater in this coming year.
Mm.
I think it's a play that connects generations. It is about an African-American publisher of books. And at this moment, Kendall is outselling actual books. He needs to adapt. He needs to save his company. So he goes through interviewing first his employees to see which one might be extinct.
Mm-hmm.
He starts having to question himself as a businessman, as an African American, as a person of a certain age. Will he become extinct himself?
Mm.
What it is about books for him, how he started out was this Bible that was passed down to him by his father, given to him by his father, who was a slave, whose eyes were taken because he dared to read. We have a generation of young people through technology. We have our iPhones that can talk to us. We can dictate to them. We don't have to read or write. And there's a generation that some, they appreciate the history that's passed down generationally. And then there are some who would rather be in the moment and shed all of it moving forward. I'm also working on a piece. I did a piece last year in New York that was a short piece called Post Black. And it was about a 110-year-old woman monologue.
Yeah.
And she's taking us through her times, our times right now, with all of the issues.
Oh, my dear.
And taking us back in history.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're a very important woman, very important artist, very important being in the world today. And I thank you.
Thank you. Your words move me.
I wrote this poem many years ago before I had met Miss Oprah Winfrey. When she found the poem, she has recited and recorded this poem with such authority that I think many people thought that I wrote the poem for Oprah Winfrey, or even more, that she wrote it for herself. I did have her in mind long before I met her. Phenomenal woman. Pretty women wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model size. When I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman. Phenomenally. Phenomenal woman. That's me. I walk into a room just as cool as you please, and to a man the fellows stand or fall down on their knees. Then they swarm around me, a hive of honeybees. I say it's the fire in my eyes. It's the flash of my teeth. It's the swing in my waist. It's the joy in my feet. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Phenomenal woman. That's me. Phenomenal woman. That's Oprah Winfrey, my next guest. Miss Oprah Winfrey.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
When I first met Miss Winfrey, some over 20-odd years ago, and she asked if she could interview me. And she said, if you will give me 5 minutes, I'll be ready for you, and I will only take 5 minutes. On the hour that she said she would show up, she came to me and said, Miss Angelo, I have the room down the hall. My camera people are there, and I'm ready for you. I sat down in the chair, and she counted down 3, 2, 1, and we began the interview. And she asked intelligent questions and had enough sense to listen to my answers. And in 5 minutes, she said, thank you very much, Dr. Angelo. It is now 5 minutes. I looked at my watch. It was exactly 5 minutes. I said, what is your name?
I remember that.
And I said, girl, you're going somewhere in this world.
Wow.
You are going to change a lot of this world, I bet you.
Just hearing you tell the story again takes me back to that moment and how nervous, both nervous and excited I was. That moment of meeting you was such a seminal moment for me because my last year in high school, I read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And it's the first time I'd ever read a book where I thought somebody knew me. I literally thought, how does someone else have my story? What it did for me was to validate my story and to validate me as a human being, to say that the life that I had lived growing up with my grandmother and learning to speak in the church at such a young age, that was all real and valid.
Miss Oprah, tell me this. Where do you get the nerve, the incredible nerve, to start on Oprah Winfrey Network?
Years ago, I was actually speaking to you. It was in the 80s. I had called you to complain about something somebody had written that, you know, didn't represent me, some tabloids. And you said to me, first of all, say thank you for whatever it is, because God has put a rainbow in the cloud. And you said, today you are worried about show business, but there will come a time you will be about your father's business. And for me, OWN is about being about my father's business. Mm. I stepped out in faith to create a channel that would service the world in helping us all to think higher and to feel deeper about things that really mattered in our lives. And so I had the courage, which you have taught me is the most important of the virtues, because without it, you can't practice any of the others. I believed that this calling that I feel so deeply inside myself was to go beyond one show, but to use that voice to try to bring a sense of consciousness to the world, thinking about things in a different way. I remember when I was on trial in Texas in 1998, and I was so afraid, and you came down and created a prayer circle and had people praying in the hotel for me. And you told me these words that have lived with me, that have actually become my mantra for life. You said, look above their heads and know in God I move and breathe and have my being. When you're sitting in front of that jury, look right above their heads and know who you are. In God, I move and breathe and have my being. And so that is my calming, centered mantra for myself all the time. In God, I move and breathe and have my being. And to know that is to live a fulfilled and powerful life for me.
Yes.
When I was growing up, I did a one-woman show in college. And with Sweet Honey and the Rock.
Yeah.
And a part, I opened it by saying, I'm one black woman born in Kosciuszko, Mississippi. Mm. One black woman, Kosciuszko, but just to hop, skip, and a jump from the Nile, just a few minutes from Ife and across the street from Kenya. Mm. One black woman, my hand in God's hand, trusting in the word, his word. It's never failed me. Yet. And so I would have to say that this journey, that I wouldn't take nothing from my journey.
That's it. Wouldn't take nothing from my journey now. A statement made by people who were enslaved, didn't have the right to move one inch beyond what the slave owner said they could move. And these people who were living lives of such outrageous cruelty said not only would they survive, they would thrive.
Right.
And these people said, I'm on my journey now, Mount Zion. On my journey now, Mount Zion, and I wouldn't take nothing. Mount Zion, for my journey now.
Yes.
Mount Zion.
Every one of those experiences has taught me, grown me, and allowed me to be who I am. I mean, even this past year, I would say.
I wanted to talk to you about the Butler movie.
Oh, yes.
Yes, ma'am.
I agreed to do the Butler after Lee Daniels was so persistent. I had so many things going on that running the network that I was reluctant to step into acting again, because it's like picking up an instrument when you haven't held it in your hands for 15 years. It's been 15 years since I acted because of the script and his vision for what it could be for our culture. It is not just the story of Eugene Allen and his wife, the real man who was in the White House from the time of Eisenhower all the way through Reagan. Mm. His story was written in the Washington Post, and he speaks of wanting to live to see the president of the United States, President Obama, be inaugurated, and he actually lived to see that. But it is our history, the civil rights movement, the feelings of the time, the aspirational, hopeful, heartfelt desires that people carried with them for a better life during that period. It's not very often that our American culture gets to experience African Americans as we truly are. I chose to play the character Gloria, the butler's wife, which when I started out, I was saying, oh, it's just a little character, it's just a small role. And as I started to research her, I recognized that the women of that time, our mothers, who really were the seed of the newborn free, really played a gigantic role in ushering in the freedoms that we now have, the freedoms that I now experience. They were the pavement. They laid the pavement that I now walk upon. When, you know, you're taking in sewing and your husband's working as a butler and you're saving every dime so that your child can have this opportunity for a better life and a better education, and that it is indeed Fisk University. Also important in the fabric of our growth as a people that binded us in this great ascent to a better life.
I know that you're going to do more things in the industry, but I don't know what more you're going to do. And we will all know. And I'm grateful for your courage and your love.
I love you.
I know that. And I love you for it.
All right.
So thank you, babe. I thank you for listening to this Black History Festival of music, of speech, of poetry, and of memory. My name is Maya Angelou, and I appreciate your ear in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just cause I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken, bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard, just cause I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your lies. You may kill me with your hatefulness. But still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so I rise.
You've been listening to Maya Angelou's Black History Month special, brought to you with help from AT&T, bringing people together to connect and create wherever they are. Learn more at att.com/thebridge. Maya Angelou's Black History Month special is distributed by the African American Public Radio Consortium and PRI, Public Radio International. Producer and executive producer Rita Coburn-Wack. Associate producer Gulnaz Syed. Field producer Michelle McKinney-Hammond. Senior editor James Slanger. Senior sound engineer Eddie Garcia. Sound engineers Bill Healy, Dale Parsons, Thomas Obing Darko. Web design Matthew Weed, 360 Savant Incorporated. Legal services provided by Linda Mensch of Brian Cave LLP, a global law firm committed to promoting diversity at www.bryancave.com, with support from member station WFDD Winston-Salem Public Radio and Omni Media Limited CITI 97.3 FM, Ghana. Maya Angelou's Black History Month special is a production of RCW Media Productions, Inc.
PRI, Public Radio International.
WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking are teaming up once again in order to bring you our 5th Annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair on Saturday, March 23rd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Henry Ford Community College Student and Culinary Arts Center. As usual, we are thrilled and excited to bring you this premier holistic event. This year's festival promises to be bigger and better than ever. If you would like to join us as a vendor, reader, or body healer, please call 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. Once again, that's call us at 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. We hope you are able to join us at this fantastic festival.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
Hey, Mom, why is the sky blue? Why don't animals talk? Why do dogs have wet noses? Why is an 11 pronounced 1T1?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
Why do I have a belly button?
But you don't have to know every answer.
Why is the ocean salty?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
Why are there 50 states?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
Why is pizza round?
They just need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Leo from PAC 1127, Dearborn, Michigan. I am at WHFR Making Waves with the Diva.
WHFR, hello. Dearborn.
Welcome to WHFR 89.3 FM. And welcome to Lyrical Infusion.